Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this is the segment we typically set aside for the arts and weekend arts events, and today is no exception. And here is WFPL's Aaron Keene with two special guests. Aaron?
Thanks a lot, Rick. I'm here with authors Al DeGenova and Pam Steele. They're both alumni of the Spalding University Master of Fine Arts and Writing Program, which is having its semi-annual residency this weekend. And they're here to read from their new books, and so they're on today to share a little bit about their writing process and a little from their new works. So, Al, your new book is Postcards to Jack, and it's poems from the road?
Right. It's traveling and place is really what it's all about, a collection of Haibun and poetry.
Wow. So Jack is Jack Kerouac, I presume.
It is Jack Kerouac. So he's addressed directly in a number of the poems.
Is he? Would you like to read one for us?
Sure. This one is called Lonesome Traveler, and it does address Kerouac. Lonesome Traveler. Kerouac, you have a way with sad. Sad cracked hands of all-night diners, sad gravel under shapeless shoes, sad waning moon of November roads, sentimental sadness, familiar sadness, old friend, sad Jack, tell me if sad tastes like black dust to you. If it smells like burning leaves, tell me it is more than easy metaphor, because I can taste it on my breakfast toast. Such a small word for a poet, so much smaller than love, the distillate of love, grand love that inspires yet lives and dies in three breaths. Sad as old as coal and deep in veins reaching to our core, old friend, the sad eternal core. Drink that last shot down, buddy. It's a long, cold walk to the diner.
Oh, thank you.
Nice.
Thank you.
And, you know, on the road is there's that sadness in there that you invoke, but it's also kind of it's written at a time where there was all this hope that you could, you know, go west, young man, and really discover America and discover your life. Well, what about your road poems, and what about writing them in the 21st century?
Well, you know, I'm obviously influenced by the Beats and Kerouac, and so the poems are addressed to him, but it's really, you know, this is about places, and there's a lot of contemporary themes in here, but it picks up on some of the aesthetic, but it's really more of a journey from one place back home. When you work through the book, it really starts in that sad point and ends up in a happy point.
Your style, I can really hear that beat influence just in the tempo and in the rhythm of your words, is there a tension there inherent in sort of invoking the spirit of the Beats, but writing from the difference between the atomic age and the Wi-Fi age, one cloud for the other?
Yeah, which is, you know, the Wi-Fi age is addressed in the opening of the book, too. It's an influence, and because I'm a jazz musician as well, that rhythm is in the way I write. And I don't really think about it as a direct influence the way the Beats wrote. It's just there, you know, and I can't get away from it.
You play saxophone, right?
Right.
And so were you a saxophone player first and a writer second, or vice versa?
Well, I started playing saxophone first, but I think they both developed kind of side by side, you know, especially through high school.
And you, I've seen some of your performances before where you kind of work the music into...
Still doing that.
How does that sort of fit in with the contemporary spoken word scene? Is jazz still as prevalent of an influence on poetry as it once was?
Well, I think now it's more, hip-hop is more the influence, but there's, you know, of course, it's still the rhythm of blues and jazz that's, you know, part of the hip-hop scene. So it's still there, even though slam doesn't allow music. You know, in a slam, it's still part of the performance for a lot of people.
They don't.
No.
I guess I never thought about that, but you don't. Pam, you've kind of seen a lot of slams too, and know a lot about that scene, yeah?
Right, and I didn't know they didn't allow music,
but it
just seems musical anyway, so because that's why we didn't notice.
Yeah. It's all a cappella.
Yeah.
Right? Well, speaking of place and the lure of place, Pam Steele is here with her new novel, Greasewood Creek. It's a love story between a woman named Avery and her boyfriend Davis, but it's also a novel of loss and mourning as well. Pam, what are you going to read for us today? Can you set that up a little bit?
I'm going to read just a short piece. It's titled Meridian. I live near the 45th parallel, and so it travels from that place back to Appalachia and back again. And what you probably need to know about this before I read it is, again, Avery is the main character. Madeline is her mother, and they're on a trip to take Madeline to a nursing home. They cross the 45th parallel, drive east toward a line of clouds that drag gray tentacles across dry land. Avery cannot smell the rain yet, how it sifts through sagebrush and jack pine, reaches into the sand and dirt of the far hills, gathers a stone-hard scent, lifts it into the wind. Rain, Madeline says. About time. We used to run from it, Madeline says. Could smell it coming, a different kind of smell than here. And we'd run up the holler to the house and put on our swimsuits. Then we'd run down the holler, meet it. Lord God, it was cold. Felt like ice hitting our skin. And if you had a sunburn, worse. She stops talking, looks out the window. Past Baker City, the rain stops. Hills, long curves. Then the land opens up north and east, stretches ahead into Idaho. The flat places remind Avery of home, of fields that say, something happened here. Places where only a moment ago there was noise and commotion, now empty, still.
Oh, thank you. And so you live in Eastern Oregon now, but you have roots in West Virginia and Kentucky. And the book goes back and forth between Appalachia and Eastern Oregon. Can you tell us a little bit about how place and landscape functioned in the writing of this book?
Actually, I was telling Al earlier that this started out as a poem, and the first two lines in the book were from a poem that I've been trying to write for a long time. And when I write poetry, I usually start with an image and then jump off from there, and then the story comes. And so that's how I did it.
Can you give us that image? Can we hear this opening line real quick?
The air still holds the shape of the house. August light pushes through cottonwood limbs, no more than air themselves, shimmers off ghost windows.
Wow. And so Pam's first book was a collection of poems, Paper Bird, too. So you started as a poet and then moved into fiction.
I have gone to the dark side.
How is that? Are you using different parts of your writer brain, or are you building from an image and it just whatever form it takes?
That's right. I start with the image. Writing fiction for me isn't that much different than writing poetry. And I remember the point in which I discovered that what you write in a poem can be fictionalized and it doesn't have to be true. So it's the same thing, only larger.
So what is it about these two landscapes that that made you want to include them both in the book?
Well, a segment of my family from West Virginia traveled to Oregon in the 1930s and homesteaded there, strangely enough, in a place that looks just like West Virginia. And there are remnants of that family left there. And I think it also comes from a sense of which landscape do I really fit into? I love this landscape that we're in now, but I also love the wheat fields and the dry land of Eastern Oregon.
Contrary magazine called your book a novel in moments, which I think is really interesting. And the structure of the book is very short scenes, and it's nonlinear, right? Can you talk a little bit about the structure?
Right. When I first thought about taking a novel workshop, I thought, I can't do this. I'm not used to writing this large. And I had a friend who encouraged me to do it. So I took the workshop under the tutelage of Jane Vandenberg out of San Francisco, and she taught us to write in episodes. And she said, you start with an episode, and then you write another one, and then you write another one. And so what I wound up with at the end were all of these episodes that I literally put on the floor of my study and moved around into something that I thought was a good order. And luckily, it stayed that way.
Al, is that sort of similar to how you put your collection of poems together?
Yeah, each one was written individually, and it wasn't until I saw them shaping themselves that I started directing the writing toward the collection, you know, where I felt there was holes. And I felt that this, that what Pam was talking about, that, you know, I've always been a poet, but writing more and more prose poems. So it's kind of the step away from the, you know, from lined poetry and into a longer thought process. And it's, I still can't get myself to even the short story point. It's still kind of, it's still daunting, but I just, you know, you go with whatever whatever the words are leading you to or the thoughts are leading you to. And so for me, they keep getting longer. So one of these days, I may get to that novel point.
Okay, so we have two poets and also a fiction writer and also a prose poet here. So do we believe in the prose poem? What is the difference between a prose poem and a lyric, image-laden scene from a novel? Al, Pam, go.
I don't think there's much of a difference. You know, I mean, in a novel, obviously, there's it's much larger. And in the prose poem, I mean, there's, you know, as Pam just read, the introduction there is a prose poem. You know, there's many novels that you can take a paragraph out and say that's a prose poem. It's, you know, is it a prose poem? Is it flash fiction? I don't know. To me, I think the only differentiation is that with a prose poem, there's much more a sense of immediacy where it's happening in the moment. And that's the only distinguishing factor that I can make, because there are prose poems that are narrative too, you know, with storyline and dialogue. But I try to do them so they feel more immediate.
We're breaking down the walls of genre right here on Byline right now. It's really exciting. Well, and so Al, tell us a little bit about the, there are a lot of haiku in your book and the haibun also, which is a Japanese hybrid form.
Right. The haibun is a combination of a prose poem followed by a haiku. They're not supposed to be directly related. The haiku is supposed to kind of augment the internal emotional side of the prose poem. So I attempted to do that, and you know that was the direction I was trying to go with the haiku, and that form is for me as a poet, it's a great in between. It lets me take the haiku, which is just that moment of emotion or, you know, observation, and tie it with the bigger scene of the place.
It's an ancient Japanese form, for those of you listening at home. Also one of, I think, the earliest forms of travel writing, too.
Yes,
Kind of a great natural fit for this book.
It fit right in with the idea of, you know, places and traveling.
Well, welcome back to Louisville, both of you. Al lives in Chicago. Pam is with us all the way from Eastern Oregon. And they'll both be reading today at 4:30 at the Brown Hotel with a whole host of other alumni from the Spalding University MFA program. Books will be for sale. There'll be signings and stuff. So if you are intrigued by what you heard, you know, come on down and hear a little more.
All right. Thanks, Aaron Keene, WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter, and to Pam and Al. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for sharing your work with us today. That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Aaron Keene. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Thanks to Joe Durso for technical support. For information on topics addressed today and to listen to today's show, visit our website, wfpl.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.